Coming up on Simply Superior. Has become known around the world, and the tragedy of his death may change race relations forever.
I want every white person right now to raise your hand. Do Black Lives Matter to you?
Yes!
Then you need to tear down the racist system that perpetuates the racism and systemic oppression.
Then, do police need to be retrained?
De-escalation doesn't require a reward. It should be what you do in the normal context of the job.
And why are there typos on the most important criminal complaint in the world? We'll speak with the experts after this. That chant was heard in Duluth last week and around the world as thousands of protesters hit the streets demanding justice for George Floyd, the Minneapolis man who died May 25th after an encounter with police, including one officer who held his knee against his neck for nearly 9 minutes. Welcome to Simply Superior. I'm Robin Washington. Less than 150 miles from our studios in Superior is Ground Zero, the streetscape outside of Cup Foods in Minneapolis South Side, where George Floyd repeatedly told Officer Derek Chauvin, "I can't breathe," and then breathed his last. For the last week, protests have erupted there and across the country, and now the world, over yet another gruesome death of a black man in an encounter with police. One of those protests was in Duluth on Saturday, co-sponsored by the Duluth Branch NAACP, the Superior African Heritage Community, and more than half a dozen other organizations. 1,000 people, nearly 100% of them wearing face masks to protect against the coronavirus, crowded the Clayton Jackson McGee Memorial and marched to Duluth's Government Center Plaza, where they held an 8-minute, 46-second period of silence, symbolic of the time George Floyd lay pinned by the neck by Officer Chauvin. Numerous speakers expressed outrage, action, and simply raw emotion over the injustice. Here are some of their voices.
We've been hearing this, "I can't breathe," for years now. And this is the movement that's growing nationally. Thank you so much for coming out. The violence is so incredible. We can't breathe at home. The violence is unreal. It's everywhere. We cannot walk to our grocery store, to the Cup Food, Cup, C-U-P, down in Minneapolis in a very old neighborhood. That is the cultural, we can't walk to the grocery store. We can't breathe. The violence is unreal. Migo Edgen, thank you so much for coming out and reminding this community and your family and for bringing that message and reminding us how devastating this is, that we cannot breathe. Whose lives matter? Whose lives matter?
Whose lives matter?
May Glitch, thank you for showing your love and support to your community and doing that in a good way. Brianna, she's an awesome young organizer here supporting Black Lives Matter, calling out justice for George Floyd. So I'm asking for Brianna to please come up and she can share a few chants too. Be good.
First of all, our numbers say a lot. Duluth, you guys have come together. And this is powerful. This is powerful because in the Twin Ports, sometimes it feels so divided, but today we are united. And that is the entire point of it. Yes. So I want to start off by explaining my intentions with this event. As a white woman with a biracial child, I can only speak from my perspective. I have no right to speak on black experience in America. I am scared for my son. I am scared for every single black life, black women, and black children. Just as everyone here, I see that the system is broken. Joe and myself wanted to create the space where minorities within this community can be heard and can be seen, and they will. And in turn, those here or watching from home who are not minorities or who have not experienced such injustices can listen and gain a new perspective of what living in America is like as a minority. We need to understand their emotion when the same officers who take an oath to protect their lives are also murdering them. Yes. This needs to happen before we can assist side by side in the upcoming steps toward change. Within the last week, so many emotions have been brought to light. There are so many lives lost behind each and every protester, organizer, and even those watching from home. We are demanding justice for George Floyd. They will say his name, and those officers must reap the consequences. Yeah. We are demanding justice and change. Today is just the beginning for Duluth and the rest of the world. We will have change. We will have a new tomorrow. We are tired, we are angry, and we are grieving. But we are united. It is time for everyone in all races, all ethnicities, in all socioeconomic backgrounds to band together to fight this injustice, because this is a war on the people. I want to finish off with this. Today is about the people. Today is about uniting and becoming one to fight this war on the people. Racism is a war on the people. And it will not go unheard, it will not go unfighted, and it will not remain in this country. Yes. Today we will be seen. Today we will be heard, and today we will make change. This is the day of the next tomorrow.
My name is Kim Young, and I'm an elder in the African Heritage community here. I wasn't scheduled to speak, but I was called last night by my sisters, my Native sisters, and asked to come and say a few words. I've led many of these marches over the year, many of these rallies over the years. This young man right here, Joe Carter and Braley, they stepped up. They stepped up into a place of leadership that we are supporting our young black leaders and organizers and citizens in this community to stand up and speak up and take the place of those of us who now must sit back and mentor them. I want every white person right now to raise your hand. Do black lives matter to you?
Yes!
Then you need to tear down the racist system that perpetuates the racism and systemic oppression. I don't want you to tear down buildings. The foundation of this country is rotten. The house that sits upon this foundation is tinkering on the brink of collapse. One swift wind will tear it down, and that's what we are demanding. We're no longer asking. We're no longer begging. Our Boston Tea Party was this week. You want peace in these streets? We can't tear down the systems of oppression and racism in this country because we didn't build them. It was built into the Constitution, which your forefathers wrote. Not mine. Mine was in the hold of a slave ship on the way over here. Mine fought in the Revolutionary War and then was told, oh, we didn't fight for your freedom. You can go back out in the fields. Mine was fought for by my father and my grandfather, who fought in wars for this country and couldn't even sit in the PX during World War II with the white German prisoners to get a cup of coffee. This is grief. This is the grief that we are seeing. We are traumatized, and I'm not okay. I'm not going to stay on this microphone long because I promised my daughter I would come over here and speak and go back. Because of this COVID, I'm a vulnerable adult. But this was that important that I put my bra on. My righteous armor. My righteous armor. I came back from retirement. I retired to take care of my body and my soul and my family. And yes, I'm a grandmother raising two young black grandsons, and I want them to live. I want us all to not be inundated with the tragedies that are now becoming classic TV to show a black man's dead body on the TV, to streaming on social media. I don't see no white bodies laying there. I've seen Palestinian bodies. I've seen Syrian bodies of children blown up from colonizers going over there and tearing down systems that were already in place, taking their stuff. Don't tell me a riot is not a political change action. The Boston Tea Party disproves that. Selma disproves that. Rosewood, Oklahoma disproved that when they bombed it. Yes, they did. They bombed it with firebombs and burnt it to the ground, all Black Wall Street. But you know what we did? We rebuilt. We took those ashes and used them for a foundation of new communities. That's what they are doing down in Minneapolis right now. Yes, they are rioting. Yes, there are outside agitators, but they don't know. We will take them ashes and stomp them into the ground and build a house that will stand for eternity based on equality, equity, and love for all human beings. Don't tell me my words are going to fall on deaf ears tomorrow.
No, it's not.
You can't go back to normal lives tomorrow. Not if you love my life. You cannot. You must leave from here today and go forth and tear it down. Pull it down. Pull it down. We are standing here today for justice for George and every other black name on the list that has been killed by police brutality, by police misconduct, by police bullets, where we stand with signs in front of them while white armed men storm capitals and go home to their families, where we have to prepare for a march so that we don't get molested by police or outside people trying to agitate. Don't let them take our movement. Don't let them take our power. And you ain't gonna take our lives no more, because we are done dying.
I'm Babette Salmon, and I'm from the Native community. I've been raised here, and I'm enrolled in White Earth. But I want to teach you one Ojibwe word, and that's Endayang. Endayang. This is our home. This is our home, so we have a decision to make for the next days going forward. We have to decide who are the warriors? Who are the warriors? Who are the warriors? Are we gonna defend our home if somebody starts busting up the If somebody starts breaking down windows and starts burning down buildings, who are the warriors that are going to defend our home and Diane? Who's going to defend our home?
Every young man needs to be up.
We are the warriors. We need to rise as warriors. We take care of each other as warriors. We love each other as warriors. I love you. I love you. As warriors, we need to defend our home. You see anybody starting to bust up our home?
We
are the warriors. We are tearing it down. Tearing down the racism. Tearing down the system that perpetuates it. Prosecutors, wake up. Start prosecuting the police officers. Wake up. Or step aside and let somebody else do the job.
All
right, Miigwech for being here and being the warriors that we need to defend.
Listen to indigenous folks. Listen to the folks that are experiencing these things. Yeah. All right, peace and justice, y'all. Yeah.
Tell us what your sign says.
It says, "Dear good cops, silence is consent."
You also have some time on there?
Sorry, I'm getting emotional, but 8 minutes and 46 seconds is how long the cop sat on George, and not able to breathe.
And your good cops is in quotation marks. Tell us what that means.
I can't speak on behalf of all cops because I have cops in my family, and I know there's some good people out there, but when they get silent, they aren't good anymore.
Your name is?
Mick. My last name is Boo. I'm from here in Duluth.
Thank you.
I can't breathe. Hello, everybody. How y'all doing? Hey, my name is Bob, and happy to be here with you guys. Yeah, I looked at the word racism. I know we all know what it means, but it says racism. A is the belief that groups of humans possess different behavior traits corresponding to physical appearance and can be divided based on the superiority of one race over another. Did y'all get that?
Yeah.
So that means nobody is over anybody. We all here are together. I mean, it's like a rainbow. I'm looking at it. It's like a rainbow. And that's what we want. We want to look like rainbows, to shine and to give everybody the same opportunity as the next person. No one is better than no one. We all are equal. So that's really what I wanted y'all to know, because we're going to stand together on this one. This one I think they messed up on. So we're going to bring it up, and we're going to find some people to represent us. Because we do not have nobody to represent us here in Duluth. We got a few people that's working, but we need some people on the ground working with our communities. So this is the beginning of something new. We're going to stay to it all summer long. We're going to find somebody that's going to look out for all of us, and not just some of us. I'm so proud that we all are peaceful. We know we're not burning nothing down. We don't need to burn nothing down right now. We're trying to build something up. And I just want y'all to know, if there's anything I can do, I will be able to do it. I will do it. So let's just hold hands and pray. Give a moment of silence to the brother George. And let's all just pray and give him a minute or so and bow our heads. Thank you all for giving me a minute or two to speak. I'm glad to see us out here today. Love y'all.
Coming here. You know, I wanted to throw this because the first protest wasn't enough, and you guys really showed out, and I appreciate that, and every single person here appreciates that. I also want to thank everyone that spoke and came out, because I know a lot of stuff was circulating the media to put us in fear and to separate us so this event wouldn't happen. And we aren't living in fear. We won't live in fear. And I thank you for that. I also thank every speaker that came out here, because a lot of people I talked to were afraid with interactions with the police that they would have afterwards. And that takes guts, that takes courage, and that takes motivation for change to put your life out there, your face out there, your words out there, your emotions out there. And I thank you for that.
We got you.
I also want to thank every single person for keeping this peaceful, because I was in Minneapolis on Tuesday. We were right in front of where George got murdered. And the unity within Minneapolis, whether people want to try to shed negative light on it or not, the unity was so beautiful. Every single word that they said hit home, and oh my God, I wish I could bring them here.
That's right.
She was talking about policing your own streets. It's happened before. It's happened before. She's talking about unity. The words that she spoke lit a fire within me, and I wish I could bring that fire, but I do not have the power that she does. I don't. And I'm gonna admit it.
You're doing good so far, baby. You're doing good. You're doing good.
But y'all did this. Y'all did this. I didn't do this. Y'all did this. We did this.
Same name!
Brandon Glenn!
Same name!
The speakers were Renee Ann Goodrich, Braylee Killeen, Kim Young, Babette Sandman, Jordan Moses, and impromptu remarks by an elder named Bob. Coming up, an analysis of police training and use of force and the charges brought this week against the officers in the death of George Floyd. Welcome back to Simply Superior. I'm Robin Washington. Cedric Alexander is a former chief of police for DeKalb County, Georgia, which contains part of Atlanta, and later was chief of police in Rochester, New York. He also has served as a federal security director for the Transportation Security Administration. He has a doctorate in clinical psychology from Wright State University in Ohio and is a past president of the National Association of Black Law Enforcement Executives. He's a frequent guest on CNN and now a first-time guest on Simply Superior. Welcome to the show.
Hey, thank you for having me. Thank you.
You're quite welcome. And we are broadcasting out of Superior, Wisconsin, where our chief is Nicholas Alexander. So any relation?
No relation, at least not that I'm aware of anyway.
All right, we'll have to make an introduction.
All right.
So I want to go right to the neck hold. And there have been some reports already saying dozens of neck holds used by Minneapolis Police Department. But are they ever allowed? And aren't officers taught basically judo, where the idea of the martial art is to prevail against your adversary?
Well, that's true. Police departments, they teach a variety of different defensive tactics to police officers. But to be perfectly honest with you, they nowhere come near being any kind of experts or proficient in judo in that regard. Neck holds and choke holds have been outlawed in many police departments, certainly within recent years. But in the case of what we saw here with Floyd, he was not resisting, and he was on his stomach, handcuffed behind his back. And that technique that you saw is not taught anywhere that I'm aware of. So that officer who killed him, who literally killed him right in front of all of us, was using a technique that he had obviously decided he was going to use. And as you saw, how cavalier he was about it, even as the man begged for breath, begged for his dying breath.
I took a module at the Duluth Police Department about 10 years ago or so on the use of force, decide how I'm going to respond with what weapon, if any. I was confronted by a person in a domestic situation with a baseball bat on the screen ready to bash my head in. I decided to use my taser. It bounced off him, and indeed I got my head bashed in. Worse than getting killed, I got yelled at by the sergeant giving the test, who said, "Didn't you consider that baseball bat a deadly weapon?" And the lesson I was supposed to take from that, which was at that time, use the next highest level of force. So if I met somebody with no weapon at all, I might use a baton. If I see somebody with a small stick, I might use a taser or something. And if I see somebody with a baseball bat, which I hadn't thought of as a deadly weapon, it's gun. It actually gets the gun very quickly. I understand most departments have re-examined that, and they now use something called a continuum of force, which says, that if the baseball bat guy comes out, but then he takes out a ball and he starts doing practice swings, you don't shoot him. So how do you unteach the first training, and can you?
Well, training has to be ongoing, and certainly things change, and as things change and new techniques develop, we have to be able to change. But the problem is, quite frankly, that police officers, at no fault of their own, really don't have the opportunity to be trained enough and frequently. And that is a huge piece of this, is that officers want the training, but oftentimes logistically, whether you're in a small department or a large department, it becomes difficult to take people out of their assignments and get them in training without having enough officers on the road, or having officers doing investigation, or much needed administrative work that need to be done. So that is always a challenge. However, that being said, today we're just going to have to find new creative ways to deliver ongoing training to our officers, not just in terms of self-defense and utilization of a continuing escalation of continuation.
Mm-hmm. Escalation, de-escalation.
And, right, absolutely, which is huge. De-escalation is huge. But it's got to be more than just going to a training block and checking a block. It has to be ongoing. Firearms training need to be ongoing. De-escalation training, ongoing. Implicit and explicit bias training, ongoing. Learning how and building relationships with communities have to become a part of the evaluation of each officer. Mm-hmm. The same way they're evaluated on number of arrests, number of tickets they write, we also got to evaluate them on how they develop and maintain relationships in the communities in which they serve.
Mm-hmm. As you say that, I'm wondering if there are awards for de-escalation? You know, you get awards for bravery, for going
not
out.
Not that I'm aware of. But de-escalation doesn't require a reward. It should be what you do in the normal context of the job.
Mm-hmm.
It's not above and beyond call of duty. Awards are what's be above and beyond.
Right. So in this case, if they de-escalated, well, first of all, he wasn't resisting anyway, so
there was nothing to de-escalate. And in fact, the public was trying to de-escalate the officers off of him so he could breathe.
We're speaking with Cedric Alexander, former chief of police for DeKalb County, and many other law enforcement leadership positions. Right now, we're looking at the National Guard being deployed across the country. Armies are not the same as police. So what do we do about what's going on right now? How do we de-escalate it?
Well, I think one thing that has to happen, we certainly cannot have buildings burning and people businesses torn apart. That is not acceptable. But we have to be very careful how we integrate our armed services into this civil and domestic event that we're all experiencing, because you do not want to over militarize, if you will, your communities with tanks and this kind of thing, because that doesn't make the job any easier. It makes it tougher. So we have to figure out, how do we make sure that we protect our businesses in our communities? And that is hugely important that we be able to do so. But at the same time, we got to make sure that people who are peaceful protesters have the right. They have the right to protest.
Right. And there are very different groups of people doing different things, right? You have protesters. You have people breaking windows who may not be the same people as setting on fire. And
that's
then you
right.
have looters
right.
who are that's people right. taking advantage of an opportunity.
That's right.
Nothing
That's
to do right. with ideology.
Those no. who are looting, absolutely they should be arrested. And those who may have some subversive ideologies, whether they're white nationalists, Antifa, or whomever, they've got to be targeted by law enforcement and taken into custody as well. But we have to very carefully and very surgically make sure that people who are peaceful protesters or afforded the constitutional right that they have to free speech, and they need to be protected by our authorities. And that is hugely important for us as a nation.
One part of de-escalation, as a final note, was the chief in Minneapolis was actually at the site at Cup Foods where Mr. Floyd was killed, and the protesters stayed after the curfew, and he stayed with them. So it was, again, that sort of modulation of escalate, de-escalate.
Right, right. That's right.
Right.
That's right.
Well, we've been speaking with Cedric Alexander, former chief of police for DeKalb County in Georgia, which includes a portion of Atlanta, and many other law enforcement agencies. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Although Officer Derek Chauvin was arrested and charged with third-degree murder just days after George Floyd died on May 25th, the other three officers involved initially remained free. That changed after Minnesota Attorney General Keith Ellison took over as lead in the case from Hennepin County Attorney Mike Freeman. And this week, all four officers were charged and a count against Chauvin, who held his knee against Mr. Floyd's neck for nearly 9 minutes, raised to second-degree murder. Yet there were errors in the filing documents before and after Ellison's office took command, including questions about the applicability of the third-degree murder charge. I spoke with a seasoned criminal defense attorney about those issues Wednesday night after the new charges were filed. We're speaking with Andrew Gordon. He's the Associate Director of the Legal Rights Center's Community Defense Program in St. Paul. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Robin. I'm glad to be here.
The charges against former Officer Chauvin have been amended to include second-degree murder, and the other three officers involved have now been charged as well and are also in custody as we speak. Have you had a chance to look at the filings?
Yes, I have.
One thing I noticed, and I'm not pretending to be a lawyer, is in the original filings, we found typos. Mr. Floyd, at certain points, was referred to as Mr. Lloyd, and likewise, Officer Lane, L-A-N-E, was referred to as Officer Lang, L-A-N-G. I actually wrote to Attorney General Ellison's office about that, and they responded saying what you pointed out was important. They intimated that they were going to bring new charges, and they have. But the new charges actually repeat some of the errors from the previous filings. So how important are typos like these?
At the end of the day, they're not very important. The facial inaccuracies that you talk about when you're talking about, you know, saying Mr. Lloyd instead of Mr. Floyd, or calling Officer Lane Officer Lang, don't change the elements of the offense and don't necessarily impact the elements of the offense. What would be egregious and what would be problematic is if, say, at trial, the jury instructions had the same errors or similar errors. That would be problematic because that would impact the deliberations themselves. But the complaint itself, if you have typos in the complaint, they happen. It's maybe not evidence of best practice, but they certainly do happen. And I think generally the way you can think about it is that most of the jurors, the individuals who would, let's say, deliberate on a case like this, they will never see the complaint, right? That the complaint will not actually go back as a piece of evidence. And for the most part, the folks who actually make it onto the jury are going to be screened for having read through the complaint prior to actually serving on the jury.
Isn't it something that the defense could bring up in trial by asking whoever wrote the filing, is it Mr. Lane or is it Mr. Lang, and getting that person to admit that the paper shows it's two different names and sowing some doubt in the jury?
If you could get someone to make that admission, yes. So the individual who would have actually drafted the complaint would have been the county attorney who filed the document itself.
Could you put that person on the stand or no?
It depends, because I know for a fact if it had stayed with the Hennepin County Attorney's Office, it would have been very difficult to call as a witness the one prosecuting the case.
There's a sequence of events, and there appears to be something missing. So it says Officer Chauvin went to the passenger side and tried to get Mr. Floyd into the car, and Lane and the defendant assisted. Then it says Officer Chauvin pulled Mr. Floyd out of the passenger side of the car at 8:19:38 p.m., so it says that they tried to get him into the car, but it doesn't say they did, and now they're pulling him out. Is something missing there?
He does, at some point, get into the back seat and then is taken out of the squad car again.
We know that happened, but again, the narrative doesn't say that.
It really just indicative of how much time someone actually sat down to put the filing together. And I would not be surprised if there were multiple people who were handling different aspects of it at different times, because it certainly does read sometimes that there are multiple authors as opposed to a single author.
All right. Well, from a more professional viewpoint, what are your concerns?
So just generally, I think there's still deficiencies with the fact that count two remains a third-degree murder charge. Third-degree murder, just from a purely legal perspective, is not the applicable charge that a prosecutor should be trying to prosecute in this case. It's deficient, it's facially deficient, it's obviously deficient, because third degree murder requires a lack of a single target, for lack of a better word or term. The classic third degree murder is someone shoots into a crowd of people. There's no intended target. You're just shooting indiscriminately. You end up hitting someone and killing them, right? Mm-hmm. So we know third degree murder doesn't apply. It's a little bit concerning that, but in amending the complaint, they didn't remove the third degree murder charge. Second degree murder, though, is far more appropriate for, I think, what all of us saw on video. It better captures what occurred on that on 30th in Chicago, and I think it's better reflective of what Officer Chauvin and his fellow officers actually contributed to.
They do mention the autopsies, or I should say different autopsies, that don't completely agree. Would the different interpretations of the autopsies all still apply for a second-degree murder charge?
I think irrespective of some of the nitpicking that's occurred, whether there is the autopsy from the Hennepin County Medical Examiner's Office or the independent autopsy that the family had authorized, I think regardless of the differences between those, all of the information I've seen seems to support a finding that a jury or a judge could find that Officer Chauvin or any of the other officers caused the death of George Floyd. I've seen nothing in any of the versions of the autopsy or any of the reporting on the autopsies that suggests that a prosecutor wouldn't be able to convince a jury that by law, Officer Chauvin caused the death of George Floyd.
And again, you are a defense attorney and you're not involved in this case. And I will remind our listeners that, however unpopular it may be to say so, that all the defendants in this case, as in any case, are innocent until proven guilty. So is there anything in this complaint that, from a defense point of view, could be capitalized off of?
Well, I think a successful defense is going to have to really hit home that Officer Chauvin or any of the other officers, their actions did not cause the death. And so insofar as you see in the complaints or as you see in any of the reporting regarding the autopsies, that there were other contributing factors. So Mr. Floyd's drug use, he had a history of heart disease. Insofar as you see those things, I think any successful defense is going to have to focus significantly on what it meant for those other things to be intervening causes of death. If a defense attorney can get in front of a jury and convince them that those other intervening causes were so significant that their effects should trump Mr. Chauvin's knee on Mr. Floyd's neck, then you would be successful. And that's really going to be the best way for, I think, a defense to be successful in this type of case.
And then lastly, from the prosecutor's point of view, given what you said, that the defense would probably argue, or their best defense would be to argue, that other factors caused Mr. Floyd's death rather than the knee to the neck for 8 minutes and 46 seconds. The burden is on the prosecution, correct? So the burden on the prosecution is to show that if someone introduces the pre-existing conditions, that the knee to the neck exacerbated his situation or certainly didn't help or indeed was the primary cause of death, correct?
Yeah, and your articulation of the cause issue just now is exactly why I think all the information I've seen in the autopsy supports a guilty finding in this case. Because really, the strongest legal argument from a cause perspective is that there was some kind of superseding cause, right? A superseding cause is something that occurs after the actions of an individual charged with a crime like this. So something would have had to occur after Officer Chauvin put his knee on George Floyd's neck. To the best of my knowledge, based on everything I've seen and read and heard, there was no superseding cause that would have contributed to George Floyd's death after Officer Chauvin put his knee on his neck. And because of that, there really shouldn't be an issue with cause, but it certainly is going to be this place where I think a defense attorney is going to focus at trial.
Okay. We've been speaking with Andrew Gordon. He's Associate Director of the Legal Rights Center's Community Defense Program in St. Paul. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
And we'll be back after this. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Simply Superior. I'm Robin Washington, and I'm joined by Brooks Johnson from the Star Tribune's North Report team. Hello, Brooks.
Hi, Robin.
And our own Superior-based reporter for Wisconsin Public Radio, Danielle Kading. Hi, Danny.
Hey, Robin.
So, of course, there were protests and other reactions outside of the Twin Ports around the world, really, but elsewhere in Wisconsin.
Yes, yeah, over the last week, we've seen days of protests in Milwaukee and Madison, and we've seen protests across Wisconsin in cities like Racine, Green Bay, Eau Claire, and so as these demonstrations are taking place, calling for justice for George Floyd, they've also taken place to call for justice for those who have died as a result of police encounters in Wisconsin, like Tony Robinson in Madison, and Joel Acevedo in Milwaukee. That incident involved an off-duty police officer. In Madison, the incident between Tony Robinson and a police officer had to do with an altercation that police said stemmed from Robinson being high on hallucinogenic mushrooms. But Tony Robinson was killed in his own home.
We're actually seeing that around the country and around the world, where other cases that were either buried or thought to have been passed are being brought to light again. Brooks, as dominating as the response to the killing of George Floyd is, it was not the only story in the area and not the only tragedy, I understand.
That's right, Robin. On Wednesday, a 6-year-old Duluth boy drowned in Lake Superior near the mouth of the Middle River. That's just east of Superior in Douglas County. The boy and a 9-year-old girl were waiting in kind of calm, shallow water, and they both encountered a drop-off on Wednesday afternoon. The girl was pulled from the water right away, but the boy took several hours to find what ended up being his body. In about 7 feet of water. The Douglas County Sheriff's Office and Medical Examiner's Office are both investigating.
A sad story indeed. Nowhere near as tragic, but affecting thousands of people in the Twin Ports, are the ongoing economic woes due to COVID-19. Brooks, I understand two employers that have been significantly hit are Essentia and the City of Duluth.
Right. One of the largest unions that represents Essentia Health employees in the region held a car caravan picket slash protest earlier this week. They honked horns and waved signs saying no layoffs, Essentia, honk for healthcare, as they said let's find other ways to face our financial woes instead of laying off. In May, Essentia announced they'd be laying off 900 people system-wide, about half of those in the Twin Ports. And then of the union jobs that would be lost, the United Steelworkers Local 9460 would bear the bulk of those. So far, layoffs have begun. There has been some progress in deciding who that's going to be, but as far as we last heard, Essentia is moving forward with all 900.
Mm-hmm. And the city?
And at the city, instead of layoffs, more layoffs, I should say, at the City of Duluth, 500 employees will take 18 unpaid days over the next 18 months in order to meet a $38 million projected budget shortfall. Already, the city's laid off nearly 50 full-time staffers and 45 temporary employees. This is to further sort of make up that expected gap in the budget from falling sales taxes, possible loss of property taxes, fees, licensing, all that stuff that has hit many cities, but none so hard, it seems, in the region as Duluth. Superior last projected about a $700,000 budget shortfall, but that was before things started opening up again a few weeks ago, and certainly they had not made any plans as of yet to lay anyone off, although the mayor said it is possible.
You know, I spoke to Superior Mayor Jim Payne, and he said that he anticipated that revenue losses would actually be reduced to about $100,000 because Superior has access to around $440,000 in funding that's reimbursable through state programs. So they're not likely to lose anything. And that's due in part to around $200 million that Governor Tony Evers has made available through the CORES Act funding to provide relief to local governments.
Well, that's good news, but I understand there's still challenges for the university system.
Yes, Robin. The University of Wisconsin system is seeing shortfalls in revenues right now due to the pandemic. President Ray Kross asked this week that Governor Tony Evers and the legislature call a special session so that they could address some financial troubles that they've been having at campuses across the state. Specifically, Cross is asking the legislature to be able to borrow money to offset some of those losses. UW system anticipates that they may lose $212 million in revenues through the summer because students obviously aren't on campus right now. They were asked to stay home, and they've had to refund millions of dollars for housing and dining. So that's something that the UW of Wisconsin system president is hoping will happen so that they can kind of limit the financial losses that they're seeing right now.
Right. All right. Well, in the face of all this adversity, at least one thing you can say is people are not sitting around doing nothing, from both government and university to, of course, people who have taken to the streets, their response to the George Floyd death. And that's our roundup of regional news. We've been speaking with Brooks Johnson of the Star Tribune's North Report team. Thank you, Brooks.
Thanks so much, Robin.
You can read the stories by Brooks and the Star Tribune's entire Twin Ports Bureau at www.startribune.com/northreport, and be sure to subscribe to their local newsletter. And we've been joined by my colleague, Danielle Kading, the Superior-based reporter for WPR News. Thank you, Danny.
Thank you, Robin.
And that's it for this edition of Simply Superior. I'm Robin Washington. Throughout this program, we've substituted our normal theme music with the more somber sounds of John Coltrane's version of Greensleeves. Here it is again. Stay safe, everyone.